We'll be introducing this morning the book of Nehemiah, so you can make your way to chapter 1 of Nehemiah, and I also will have you open and place a bookmark at 2 Kings chapter 17, and also Jeremiah chapter 52. If you're like me, you've got a bunch of scraps of paper hanging out of the top of your Bible, and you can grab them. My Bible looks like it needs a haircut. It has so many things hanging out of it. You could put bookmarks, 2 Kings 17 and Jeremiah 52. Today's sermon is a history lesson. We learn from history. Winston Churchill is credited with saying, "Those that fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it." Well, the truth be known, history never repeats itself exactly, although there can be many similarities. But every single historical moment stands distinct from all of those leading up to it. But we have to learn from history. We learn from our mistakes, and we learn from the mistakes of others so that we don't run the risk of repeating them. You know, there's so much energy spent modern day in an effort to rewrite history. But how much better it would be just simply to acknowledge the failures of the past and purpose to not repeat them. History provides us information, often in the form of living examples. And from these living examples, we get principles for life ourselves. So who is Nehemiah? Well, his name means God comforts. I'm thankful for that name. God comforts. He was not a king, although he would have made a good one. He was not a prophet, although the book, Nehemiah, starts with the words of Nehemiah. It sounds prophetic, but he was not a prophet. He was not a priest, although we find as we read through the book that he supported the priesthood. So what was he? He was just a man, but an impressive one. He's a dedicated layman. So that ought to be an encouragement to us as we move through this book. He was a dedicated layman called by God to serve in hard times, when the Israelite people had been traumatized by decades of servitude in Babylon. When God needs a tool, he forges it himself. Nehemiah is that tool. When God needs a man, he makes a man, like Moses or Joshua or John the Baptist or the Apostle Paul. You see it as you move through the Bible. Every time he needs a tool, he forges it himself. The book of Nehemiah shows us the kind of significant impact one individual can have on a nation. Nehemiah served in a secular office, but he used his position to further the kingdom of God. Swindoll says God uses all manner of people in all manner of places doing all manner of work. Somewhere I can fit in there. And you too. And Nehemiah, not a king, not a priest, not a prophet, but a man, a layman. The book of Nehemiah fulfills that word that we studied in Colossians chapter 3. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all to the glory of God. Nehemiah fits in that category. Well, he was called by God to serve in a hard time. In the biblical accounts, the call of God to a man for a particular work frequently begins with what one man I read says, an arresting assertion of the divine initiative. He's captivated by God doing something here, and it falls on me. Sometimes there's an overwhelming awareness of a need brought to mind by a crisis. And such people that are called under those circumstances don't just decide to serve. It's as though the decision has already been made for them. The call of God. This book of the Bible is filled with compelling excerpts from personal memoirs, we could say. And it's flavored with high drama. I love that about it. It's an autobiographical work in nature, and most of it's written from the first person. And it's very vivid and frank in his reporting. He just tells it like it is, Nehemiah. Lays it right out there. The account is full of monumental stories from a man who demonstrated unmatched skills in leadership and organization. That'll come to light as we study through this book. But at the same time, Nehemiah exhibited humility and integrity and compassion. He's an example of raw faith. He just believed God. And undaunted courage in the face of opposition and attacks. And national patriotism. He promoted partnership. He displayed heroism at times, and all of that under the umbrella of uncompromising godly piety. That's Nehemiah. So let's look at Nehemiah chapter 1, the first four verses, and read them. The words of Nehemiah, the son of Hakaliah. Now it happened in the month Chislev, in the 20th year, while I was in Susa, the capital, that Hanani, one of my brothers, and some men from Judea came, and I asked them concerning the Jews who had escaped and had survived the captivity about Jerusalem. And they said to me, the remnant is there in the province who survived the captivity, and they are in great distress and reproach. And the wall of Jerusalem is broken down, and its gates are burned with fire. Now it came about when I heard these words, I sat down and wept and mourned for days. And I was fasting and praying before the God of heaven. Now I want to read to you a portion in Psalm 137. This is the song of the exiles. By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. Upon the willows in the midst of it we hung our harps, for there our captors demanded of us songs, and our tormentors in their mirth saying, sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song in a foreign land? If I forget you, O Jerusalem, may my right hand forget her skill, and may my tongue cleave to the roof of my mouth. If I do not remember you, if I do not exalt Jerusalem above my chief joy. The song of the exiles. Now you tie that with the first four verses we just read there in Nehemiah, and it makes me ask the question, how did we get here? What happened? Well, I'm going to give a narrative to you here, kind of fast-paced. And I don't expect you to remember everything that I say, but it might help if you just pull back and get an overview. Because we're dealing with a specific time in Nehemiah, a specific point in history. And it helps to know a little bit how we got here in the first place. Abraham, you remember, is the father of the nation. He was called by God from the land of Ur of the Chaldees. Ironically, that's Mesopotamia, a near neighbor to Babylon, which is where all of this is taking place in Nehemiah. Abraham came from there. God called him. He believed God. God didn't even tell him where he was going, and God counted it as righteousness for Abraham. Led him all the way through the desert to arrive at the land of Canaan, and said, I'm going to make a great nation out of you. And he bid him to look around and said, everything that you can see is going to be yours. That was Abraham, a pagan from the Babylon area. Well, from there Isaac was born, the child of the promise. Abraham, he had a good point. How are you going to make a nation out of me? I don't even have a son. Well, Isaac was born, child of the promise in Abraham's old age. A wife was sought for Isaac. You know where they sought for the wife for Isaac? Back in Mesopotamia. And Rebekah was brought. And so Isaac had a wife, had children. Jacob was born. Jacob fled from Esau. Where did he flee to? Mesopotamia. And he got Rachel and Leah as wives. And then he came back to the land of Canaan and became the father of 12 tribes, which were eventually the nation of Israel. Well, one of Jacob's sons, Joseph, was hated by the others, sold into slavery, and he ends up in Egypt. And he rises to second in power with Pharaoh. Now, who did that? God did that. And by interpreting a dream of Pharaoh, it's determined that there is going to be 7 years of plenty followed by 7 years of devastating famine. And Joseph gathered plenty of food in those 7 years of prosperity so that when the 7 years of famine came, everybody was coming to him to get something to eat, including Jacob and his family from the land of Canaan. We're told 75 persons in all. God did that. So Jacob and his family are now in Egypt. As time goes on, Joseph dies. Another Pharaoh arises. The nation of Israel, or the 75 people, are blessed and they become a nation of people to the extent that Pharaoh is worried about them and makes slaves out of them all. But God delivers the nation from the Egyptian slavery and bondage with a powerful outstretched arm. Plagues that devastated the land. And he leads through Moses this nation formed from the 12 tribes of Jacob across the Red Sea that he parts for them to walk across. And he destroys a pursuing army. God did all of that. The nation of Israel. Now the nation of Israel, led by Moses, goes through the wilderness, arrives where? At the land of Canaan, the border of Canaan. They refuse to go in because they don't believe God. And he turns them around and marches them around in the desert for 40 years until that whole generation dies. And they arrive at the border of Canaan again, this time under the leadership of Joshua, their captain. Well, God parts the Jordan River all the way back at Adam, 20 miles upstream, and it was in flood stage. And they cross the Jordan River into the promised land under Joshua. The first obstacle they face is the fortified city of Jericho. Well, they march around Jericho, and Jericho falls with a shout, nothing else. The walls fall down. Who did that? God did it. Well, under Joshua, the land of Canaan, the promised land is taken, nation after nation, until the nation of Israel begins to enjoy vineyards that it did not plant and live in cities that it did not build. That land of Canaan that God, all the way back there, promised to Abraham to give it to him, to his descendants after him. Now they're there. And they're enjoying prosperity after all that I just said to you. They arrive there. The land flowing with milk and honey. Well, what happens? They demand a king of the good judge Samuel. Why did they do that? So they could be like the other nations around them? And so God relents and gives them Saul. Be careful. Sometimes you might get what you ask for. He gives them Saul, who had a disastrous reign. And as a result, David was anointed king, a man after God's own heart. Well, David had some of his own exploits. You ever heard of Jerusalem? Of course you had. It's in our text even today. Well, Jerusalem at that time, when David was king, was occupied by the Jebusites. And Jerusalem is a very fortified city. I mean, it is naturally defensible. It's surrounded by deep valleys on three of its sides and high walls and towers at the corners. I mean, it's defensible. And the Jebusites, in their trash talk, said to David, "Even the lame and the blind can defend our city against you." Well, so what happened? Well, David and his valiant men performed what would be a modern-day Navy SEAL assault. They came up through the water supply for the city and took it. Now, who did that? God did it. Gave David Jerusalem. It was called the City of David. It's called Zion, the city of our God, and established his worship in Jerusalem. Now, that's how we got to Jerusalem. David purposes in his heart to build a temple for the worship of God because God's being worshiped in a tent. It was a tabernacle. They brought the tent of meeting to Jerusalem along with the Ark of the Covenant. God was worshiped in a tent, and David said it shouldn't be like this. But God said, God revealed that it's not going to happen in David's lifetime, but in his son Solomon's lifetime. So David began to prepare. And when David passed off the scene, Solomon started building the temple, and that temple was a grand temple. It was extravagant in every way. In fact, we're told in the Bible that there was so much gold in that temple, silver didn't even amount to anything. It was worthless. He imported cedars from Lebanon, and they had the finest of tapestries and all of this craftsmanship and beauty in honor of the worship of God. It took them years to do, to build that temple. Well, how could that come about? Because God, the Bible tells us, gave Solomon rest from all of his enemies on every side. If you lead an undistracted life, you ought to be thankful to God for that. He didn't have to fight any battles. David was a warrior. He was always fighting battles. But not Solomon. God arranged that, you see. Well, from there it went downhill. Solomon took many wives, foreign wives. They led him into idolatry. And God punishes that idolatry by ripping 10 tribes away from Solomon and leaving him with two, Judah and Benjamin. And the other 10 tribes, they go north to Samaria. And the kingdom is divided. Judah and Benjamin are in the south. They're centered in Jerusalem. The other 10 tribes establish their worship in Samaria under the kingship of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, who caused Israel to sin. How did he cause Israel to sin? He set up a golden calf in Bethel and Dan. And he said, "Behold, Israel, these are your gods. You don't have to go down to Jerusalem to worship." Caused Israel to sin. All of that's going on in Samaria in the north, another fortified city. So you have two separate kingdoms, one in the north, one in the south, two separate kings. Sometimes they get along, sometimes they don't. You can read all about it in the Chronicles of the Kings. Successive kings, one after the other, and you can see the descent into idolatry being influenced by all the nations around them. You can see the decline. It started whenever they didn't want a theocracy, God as king anymore. They wanted a monarchy, a man as king. And this is the decline. So there are many kings, a succession of kings, a few good ones, most of them bad. And the two kingdoms decline spiritually over time. They get worse and worse. You know, there's a principle. Health is not contagious. Disease is. And that's how it happened. Well, I asked you to mark your Bibles in 2 Kings. Chapter 17. Verse 4, there was a king, Hoshea, and he rebelled against Shalmaneser, the king of the Assyrians. And verse 5, then the king of Assyria invaded the whole land and went up to Samaria and besieged it. So here's the land in the north. Here's the city capital in the north, Samaria, besieged by the king of Assyria. He besieged it for 3 years. Now, that's a military tactic. You know, you don't have to fight much of a battle if you can starve people out. 3 years they set up a siege works, no one in, no one out, until the people are starving to death. Then it's pretty easy. That happened in Samaria. Now look how it happened. Verse 7, now this came about because the sons of Israel sinned against the Lord their God, who brought them up from the land of Egypt and from under the hand of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and they feared other gods, and they walked in the custom of the nations, whom the Lord had driven out before the sons of Israel, and in the customs of the kings of Israel, which they had introduced. In verse 9, the sons of Israel did things secretly, which were not right against the Lord their God. And it describes how they built high places. And then they built watchtowers, from watchtower to watchtower in fortified cities. And they set up pillars and asherim on every hill, under every green tree. You see the progression. Started out secretly. Now this is really public. And there they burned incense on the high places. Verse 12, they served idols, which the Lord had said, you shall not do this. Then the Lord warned Israel and Judah through all of his prophets, every seer, saying, turn from your evil ways, keep my commandments. Verse 14, however, they did not listen but stiffened their neck, like their fathers who did not believe in the Lord their God. Anytime you have a warning from God, we better heed it. Not stiffen our necks. They rejected his statutes. They rejected his warnings. They forsook all of his commandments. In verse 16, they had two images, molten images, two calves made in Asherah. They worshiped all the hosts of heaven. I mean, they're all in by this time. And then it says they made their sons and their daughters pass through the fire. Child sacrifice of all things. And they practiced divination and enchantments, witchcraft. And the Bible tells us they sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord, provoking him. That's how Samaria got to where it was. Until verse 18, the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them from his sight. King of Assyria besieged them, starved them out, took them off. The Lord did that. Never to return, I'm going to point out. In fact, they're called the lost tribes of Israel. They never made it back to Samaria. That's the end of the northern kingdom right there. And we just looked at the decline preceding it. It started out with verse 9 doing secret things, and it ended in verse 17, all manner of wickedness and evil. Well, the king of Assyria decides to repopulate the land of Samaria, and he does it with other captive nations. He brings them in and starts to settle them in homes that used to be the nation of Israel. And of course, they're idol worshipers, those other nations. And so God sends lions. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. God sends man-eating lions to kill some of them. And it must have been, I don't know how all of that looked, but it must have been in such a way that the king of Assyria and the people of the land said, God is doing this. He's angry with us because his worship isn't happening here anymore. And so what's their workaround? They go all the way back to Assyria, grab a priest, a Jewish priest, bring him back to Samaria to try and incorporate a little bit of the worship of Jehovah in with all these other gods so we can get rid of these lions. That's what actually happened in the repopulation of Samaria. It's an amazing account. They import a priest and they start teaching religion as a performance. So here you have religion as something we add on. The worship of God. I live my life however I want, but as long as I go to church and I incorporate a little bit of Jesus into it, I'm all right. It's so superstitious. It's just a false fear of God. But the Bible tells us that in this very chapter. Verse 41, so while these nations feared the Lord, they also served their idols, their children likewise, and their grandchildren as their fathers did, all the way into this day. This is a blending of religions together. And in fact, in Ezra chapter 4, whenever the temple under Zerubbabel is being built, these very people came down to Jerusalem and said, we want to help you. After all, we serve the same God. And Zerubbabel bluntly declined. You don't have any part in this with us. Here you've got true worship of God, and you've got some kind of syncretistic blend, a Jesus add-on, and they're incompatible. And I would point out that this right here is the beginning of the mongrel race called the Samaritans that are despised in the New Testament. These are the Samaritans. You remember Jesus met that woman at the well? She said, well, what are you talking to me for? The Jews don't have any dealings with Samaritans. This is the start of all of that. Well, Judah in the south follows the very same path of decline. And 135 years later, Jerusalem falls. They stiffened their neck against all the prophets. God sent prophets to warn them. Reminds me of Proverbs 19:1. He who is often reproved, but yet stiffens his neck, will suddenly be broken without healing. Well, I had you mark Jeremiah 52. Jeremiah 52 gives us the fate of Jerusalem. Verse 4, it came about in the ninth year of his reign, on the tenth day of the tenth month, that Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came, he and all his army against Jerusalem, camped against it, and built a siege wall all around it. So the city was under siege until the 11th year of the king of Zedekiah. Samaria was under siege for 3 years, Jerusalem 2.5 years. And on the ninth day of the fourth month, the famine was so severe in the city that there was no food for the people of the land. And then the city was broken into, and all the men of war fled and went forth from the city by night by way of the gate between the two walls, which was at the king's garden, though the Chaldeans were all around them, the city, and they went by way of the Arbah. And the army of the Chaldeans pursued the king, overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho, and all his army was scattered from him. So they captured King Zedekiah, who was fleeing the last minute, getting out of Dodge, escaping with his own life, They captured him, and the sentence on him was they made him watch while they killed all of his sons, and then they put out his own eyes, blinded him. The last thing he saw was his own sons being killed, and then threw him in prison. Verse 12, now on the 10th day of the 5th month, which was the 19th year of King Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, Nebuzaradan, the captain of the bodyguard who was in the service of the king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem, and he burned the house of the Lord, that's Solomon's temple, and the king's house, and all the houses of Jerusalem, and even every large house he burnt with fire. So all the army of the Chaldeans who were with the captain of the guard broke down all the walls around Jerusalem. Devastated it. It was a scorched earth policy. And they carried away into exile the people, some of the poorest they left in the land. And they took away the utensils of the temple, the worship of God, and everything that was worth anything. They carried it off. That was the fate of Jerusalem. Well, meanwhile, back in Babylon, the Chaldeans and the Babylonians, God punishes them for their pride. Remember Nebuchadnezzar? He was so proud and lifted up. And Daniel gives us an account. He was a prophet that was going prophesying at this very time. Daniel gives us that account of the pride of Nebuchadnezzar and the pride of Nebuchadnezzar's reigning son. And we have that famous account of the handwriting on the wall. Remember that? The interpretation of that was God's taking the kingdom from you and giving it to another. And that very night, the Persians took over Babylon. Well, the Persians. 2 Chronicles chapter 36 ends. It's the very last two verses of the entire book. It ends with God stirring up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he proclaims the Jews can go back to Jerusalem. Now, who did that? God did that. After 70 years of captivity. Those same two verses are the two verses that open in the book of Ezra. Well, in 536 BC, Zerubbabel returns under the blessing of King Cyrus, and he was funded by the pagan Assyrian King Cyrus to go back to Jerusalem and rebuild the temple. It's amazing. You can't make it up. God did it. So they go back and begin rebuilding the temple in Jerusalem. And that very action of Cyrus, Isaiah the prophet predicted 200 years before that it would happen. God fulfilled that. In fact, it is said of Cyrus, he is my shepherd, my servant, a pagan king, and he shall fulfill all my purpose, saying of Jerusalem, she shall be built, and of the temple your foundation shall be laid. That's what Isaiah prophesied 200 years before it ever happened. Well, the first six chapters of Ezra chronicles that for us, the return of the exiles under Zerubbabel to rebuild the temple. And it gets to the spot where the temple is foundation is laid. And then these Samaritans want to come down and help, and they're turned away. But the foundation of the temple is laid. Now, there were some people that were alive then that had seen the previous one. They were still around, some of those old guys. What do you call them? Septuagenarians or something? seven generations. They remembered what the old temple was like under Solomon, and they wept when they saw this greatly diminished little foundation of a building, whereas others were rejoicing in it. You couldn't determine the difference. It was heard for so far away. Some people lamenting, some people rejoicing. But the prophet Haggai, who was prophesying during that point in time, he reproved them for despising the day of small things. And what was it? It was God doing something again. But here, these were looking back on the past, and they were despising that day of small things. Well, the work is opposed there in the land on that temple, and it was halted for 20 years until the ministries of Haggai and Zechariah urged the finishing of the temple. And so under Zerubbabel and Joshua the priest, it's finally finished in the year 515. And during that span, life in Persia is going on during that time. Esther becomes queen of Persia in 479 for such a time as this. Now, who did that? Who installs a Jewish woman to be queen of Persia? God did it. And why did God do it? Because the entire Jewish nation in captivity would have been annihilated if he didn't do that. Haman saw to it. But God thwarted that. And so here is Esther, she's the queen, and Mordecai is advanced to being second in power to the king himself, Mordecai, a Jew. It's amazing the hand of God through all of this. Artaxerxes eventually becomes king in Persia in 464, and in 444 we arrive at Nehemiah. So all of that is history leading up and answers the question, how did we get here? Samaria is gone, never to return. Jerusalem is torn up and devastated. And word comes to Nehemiah. Esther has already been on and off the scene. So themes that are present here. One, God is sovereign. Nehemiah prays to the God of heaven. Someone has said, God has fashioned every link in the complicated chain of human history. It doesn't just happen and he reacts. He does it. He accomplishes his purposes. The nations are like a drop in the bucket. They're like dust on the scales. All the nations are as nothing before him. They're even less than nothing, Isaiah says. And Daniel says he changes times and seasons. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise. And to those who have no understanding, he gives knowledge. Daniel said that. So times and seasons, they change for us, don't they? But God is the one behind it all. Another theme that stands out in all of this is providence. Nehemiah had risen to a high position in the government of the most powerful nation on earth at that time. And like Esther, here he is, a Jew, he's a captive, he served a pagan king in a very strategic capacity because God did it through providence. Nehemiah had the respect and the trust of the king. He was the cupbearer to the king. The king was staking his life every time he took a drink of the chalice that Nehemiah was doing his job. He trusted him. Nehemiah was true to God and he was true to his country. He balanced both of those things. His usefulness was greater in the court at that point in time than it ever could have been in the homeland until God ordered that he would go on that pilgrimage and imparted that vision to him. The providence of God. The timing of it. It's God's timing. Seasons belong to Him. Events belong to Him. We read these words, "Now it happened in the month Chislev in the 20th year." Now it happened. God's seasons and times. In most people's lives, there are dates or times that stand out more than others. You can look back on it and you can say, "Oh, I remember such and such a year and month, this happened. Such and such a time, this changed." There are times of greater impact. There are times of change, crisis, loss, testing your faith, counting the cost. Seasons that stand up, they have a spike and they stand right up. It's like the month of Chislev in the 20th year. I remember this happened. Well, all of those seasons and all of that timing, it belongs to God. The month of Chislev is the November-December season, I'm told. There are some of us that might be in the November-December time of our life. But when you follow God and you have God as your leader, it's nothing to fear. Well, the place, think about the providence of the place. It's Susa, the capital of Persia. That's the palace resort of the king of Persia. That's where Esther sat as queen, right there in Susa, in a previous administration years before. And if God had not delivered the nation from annihilation under Esther, at the time of Esther, Nehemiah wouldn't even be here. God did all of that. Well, Nehemiah inquires about the people. Some had escaped, some survived the captivity. And the poorest of the people were still in the land left behind. He inquires about the people and he inquires about the place, Jerusalem, his homeland, the city of David. That's a place that Nehemiah had never seen before. He'd never been there. He was born in captivity. And the report he got, those survivors that are back there are in great distress. They're in hard times of adversity and they're a mockery of the people around them. They're under great reproach. And the city, as for the city geographically, the walls are all broken down and its gates are burned with fire. There's frightening insecurity. And it's probably not referring just to the original assault on the kingdom, because under Zerubbabel, while the temple was being built, they were attempting innocently to build the walls when they met with opposition. Well, the reaction of Nehemiah, he was affected by this hardship, and emotions are real. He was overcome with grief, and he wept, it says, for days. He was a broken-hearted man. Sometimes there are seasons like that, profound grief, days of sorrow. Jeremiah, the weeping prophet, said, "Oh, that my head were waters and my eyes a fountain of tears, that I might weep day and night for the slain of the daughter of my people." Well, he was unable to function normally. He says he sat down, he was stunned. Have you ever been hit with news that was stunning? It reminds me of our Lord Himself, who was a man of sorrows, and He knew well the pain of grief. Luke 19:41 tells us, when He approached Jerusalem, He saw the city and wept over it. Why? Because He saw the future. Walls were coming down again. The temple again, was their house was going to be left to them desolate. Well, Nehemiah poured out his heart to God. He fasted, he prayed, he humbled himself. And there's a lesson right there. Before he ever went to see the king, he saw God. He sought God. You and I, in the midst of difficulty, distress, and discouragement, God is the first one we should seek before anybody else. King Asa, we're told, was diseased in his feet, and he sought the physicians, but he did not seek God, and he was condemned for it. So that's a start to the book of Nehemiah and to Nehemiah's experience. And Lord willing, in future sermons, we'll take it from here. We leave Nehemiah seeking the presence of the Lord, fasting and praying and weeping before God, a man affected and brokenhearted because of the condition of his homeland and the people that are left there. Now it happened.